Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased in this first hour of Focus 580 to have as our guest Gwen Ifill, and we will be talking about her recent book. The title is The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Doubleday is the publisher. In this book, she profiles several young African-American politicians, among them President Barack Obama. And the book makes the argument that we are at a pivotal moment in American history as the political structure of the civil rights movement gives way to the generation who are the direct beneficiaries of that struggle of the 1960s. The book's gotten a lot of attention, and we're glad that she could be with us to talk about it. People who are listening, I'm sure, know that Gwen Ifill is the moderator and managing editor of Washington Week, a program broadcast across the country on PBS, on stations including ours. She's also senior correspondent of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Before coming to PBS, she was the chief congressional and political correspondent for NBC News. She's also been a reporter for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, and the Boston Herald American. As we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. We ask only that when people call in, they try to keep their questions and comments brief. We ask that so that we can keep moving along, get in as many callers as possible. But callers are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Ms. Ifill, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. And how are you?
I'm terrific.
Good. I appreciate very much you giving us some of your time.
Happy to be with you.
The book, particularly last fall in the run-up to the vice presidential candidates debate, the book and you got a lot of attention. And at some point, I want to talk about that and have you talk about that. But the reason that I mentioned the fact that it got right at that point and got a lot of attention, yesterday one of the things that I looked at was a talk that you gave, and I think this was sponsored by or organized by the people at Google. And one of the things that you said I thought was very interesting, you were talking about the fact that, in a sense, you'd been working on this story, perhaps collecting little bits of the story, maybe not even knowing that it was a story, for decades, probably. So you didn't just, this story just didn't start, and in a way, you didn't just start thinking about it last summer or last fall or, you know, whenever it was, it was getting so much attention.
Absolutely. I think some people had some trouble taking that in because they had never thought about it before. But I'd probably spent my entire career unwittingly thinking about the subject matter of what happens when race and politics intersect. I mean, I've always wanted to be a political writer and loved covering politics. And to me, the idea of politics is more about the horse, more than about the horse race. It was about the consequential outcomes in people's lives based on the decisions that politicians and elected officials and government leaders make. And so growing up, at the time I grew up, I saw the direct connection between what happened when someone passed a civil rights public accommodations law and my life. I'm an African American. I saw that there was a direct connection. But then you take it to the next step and you watch as my career went along, where I kept happening into situations where I was watching kind of a shift of power happen between the majority population and the minority population, whether it was in Boston when I covered school busing crises or whether it was in suburban Washington when I covered, you know, zoning boards. I mean, I covered all the basic places that young reporters go, but everywhere along the way, when I stepped back and thought about it, I realized there was this shift happening. There was this clash happening, a shift of power from the majority to the minority. It was an interesting time to come of age in journalism, and I also had covered my first presidential campaign. Among other people, I covered Jesse Jackson. So I got to watch a lot of what happened when you had a brand new kind of person running for president. So Barack Obama was not new to me. He woke up a lot of other people to the topic, but I've been thinking about it for a long time.
Yeah. Something else that you said that I thought was very interesting, and I noted down the words in talking about the individuals that you profile in the book, that you said they learned how to take advantage of being underestimated.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that a lot. And that
you know?
Says something about how also, you know, that this is in a way, this is a story that probably a lot of people missed. And that maybe has something to do with the kind of strategy that people not only like Mr. Obama employed, but the other people like Cory Booker and Deval Patrick and Archer Davis, the people you profile in the book, the strategy that they also employed.
It's a strategy a lot of accomplished women and people of color have employed for years. Once they got access to higher education, once they got access to the job market, once they got access to things that their parents were denied, then they had to deal with the attitudes of the people who were already there. Often those attitudes were, it's not your time, Sonny, it's not your time, little girl, just wait over there in a corner and we'll call on you. And so they would just say, well, it turns out I am fluent in Arabic. You didn't expect that of me, did you? Or it turns out that I know how to speak to voters who no one has ever bothered to speak to before, and I know how to make the case to them that I can represent their interests more effectively. And once the comfortable, kind of fat and happy leadership was looking the other way or expecting very little, this has happened in my own career. Different points in my career, I've worked for people who said, oh, you can't do that, you're not ready to do it. And when you do it anyhow, any minor achievement shocks them so much they give you extra credit for it, even mm-hmm. though you knew you were perfectly capable. And that's true as well of a lot of these breakthrough politicians I write about in the book, because whether it was Barack Obama this year or Deval Patrick running for governor of Massachusetts in 2006 when he had never run for anything before, or Arthur Davis, a congressman from Alabama who's running next year for governor of Alabama, a state that in my lifetime had George Wallace as governor, or whether it's Cory Booker, who grew up in a white suburb in New Jersey, where his parents literally were both IBM executives. They literally integrated it in order for their sons to get a better shot at public education. Yet when he chose to take advantage of his Oxford and his Stanford education, he went back to the inner city, back to Newark, to try to save the city. Each time, expectations were set differently for all these individuals, and each time, in order to truly break through, they had to take advantage of the fact that people expected less of them and then exceed it.
Hmm. I was very struck by an exchange between President Obama and one of the reporters in his last primetime news conference. And one of the reporters, a woman, got up, and I don't remember word for word the question she asked, but essentially it was about race in America, race in politics, and the implications of his being elected president. And I thought his response was very interesting for a variety of reasons, both because it says something about, again, the approach of the people, that kind of people that you write about, but I think it also says something about Barack Obama. And he almost brushed the question aside. He said something like, you know, we were basking in the glory of this new day on race, and he said that lasted for a day. And then he said, and then it was time to get to work. And I thought, it came back to me as I was thinking about that we were going to have this conversation. And I thought, boy, that's it right there in a nutshell, isn't it?
That is it. You know what? That question was asked by Ann Compton, who's a reporter for ABC Radio. She's covered many presidents. She knows her way around the White House, and she knows how to ask a good question. You'll recall that when he called on her, she was a little surprised to be called on.
Yes, yes.
And yet she came out with what, to the kind of the naked eye, looked like a casual, what is it about race, Mr. President? She was very open-ended, and he could have gone anywhere he wanted to with it. What are your reflections on this? And it was a brilliant question in that respect, which is why I think there usually are no dumb questions, even though there are some underinformed ones sometimes. This one was very smart because it allowed him to set the tone for how he would respond to this question. If you had overthought that question, he could have minimized it even more. But in fact, his answer was very revealing. It was, this is great what happened. We all had this wonderful moment, but you know why I'm here tonight? I'm here to talk about this huge crisis the country is facing. And if I were to talk about race, I'd be talking about me. My job is to be here to talk about you and talk about the American people. And this is what the American people care about. All smart politicians know that in the end, especially in times of crisis, you don't turn it into a discussion about yourself. You turn it into a discussion about the people who are suffering. And so he used this as an opportunity to say, if you're at home and you're looking at me and you're still thinking about my race, you're not paying attention to the real challenges we have in front of us. Mm-hmm. Let's get past that, move on to something else. I'm not saying that I don't believe, David, in a post-racial world. I don't think we're past it. I think there are still some people who are completely caught up with the idea of it. But I do think that when you give a guy a job, the most important judgment people are putting on him is whether he does the job. And if he were to fail, perhaps people would say, revisit race and try to say this had something to do with it. I don't even know if that's true. But what this gave him an opportunity to say was, yeah, that's all well and good. Making history is great. But once you get through the door, you still have to perform.
Yeah.
That's true of anybody who's ever been a beneficiary of any kind of preference, for instance. Affirmative action may have gotten you in the door, but if you don't know how to do the job, you're not going to stay there long. So that's the way he's looking at this.
Yeah. And it also, it strikes me that it says something about him and his care in responding to questions, the fact that he plays the cards pretty close to the vest, and how different he is in about self-revelation than, for example, somebody like Bill Clinton, who, you know, all you had to do was open the door and of that man, and still, it will just flood out.
He's different about self-revelation than even Barack Obama. I mean, Barack Obama's first book, Dreams from My Father, is the most revelatory book that any person who later went on to become president has ever written. He spends a lot of time in that book thinking about race and about identity and about choices and about how one evolves as a man in this society. It's a very interesting read and provides a very insightful look at who Barack Obama is. But he wrote that when he was 22 years old. Mm-hmm. He's now the president of the United States, and he doesn't afford himself he doesn't afford us, I suppose, that kind of glimpse anymore. It's a lot tougher to see inside his soul, as it were, than it used to be. And I would compare that also. Actually, I think the more apt comparison is to, rather than Bill Clinton, is to George W. Bush, who also wasn't very good, remember, as president, at looking inward or mulling around, out loud about his feelings about things. He resisted it and sometimes was mocked for resisting it, for not being reflective enough. But as president, you kind of have a different role. And even though Bill Clinton may have seemed like he was telling you a lot about himself, if you go back and look at it, he really was telling a lot of stories, but he wasn't being very revealing. And I think that comes with being president as well.
Yeah. Maybe just one other question, just specifically about Mr. Obama. And I'm interested in your thoughts because you're somebody who can see him and see politics up close. I'm sure that every president, the popular media and people in the comedy business, you know, they'll find something about the president to make fun of. And I think that it's interesting that in Mr. Obama's case, it seems that the thing that they pick to make fun of is that he's smart and that he's very reserved. And I'm interested in what you make of that, particularly the fact that the one thing that we grabbed on to kind of rib the guy about is his calm.
I think they're having a really hard time grabbing on something to rib him about, because what's funny about being calm exactly?
Yeah.
I mean, if you watch the Imitations on Saturday Night Live, you can see they're still trying to figure out what one does with this. You're right. They had Dwayne the Rock Johnson pretend to be the Incredible Hulk.
I thought that was a pretty funny sketch.
What happened if Barack Obama finally got mad? You know, that's all they've got, and they're having some difficulties. You can tell from the jokes they tell, trying to find a way, because he doesn't have any. He's not a larger than life personality like Bill Clinton was, and he's not as ungifted in the English language as George W. Bush sometimes could be, which gave him people a way of mocking him. Right now, the mockery is partly limited by the fact that the country is in such dire straits. It's always a little bit more difficult to come up with comedy at moments like this. I don't envy them that job.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Gwen Ifill. She's moderator, managing editor of Washington Week, and senior correspondent of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And she is the author of a recently published book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, published by Doubleday. Our number here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, here, I'm about to ask you a question I realize is big and open-ended, but here it is. So what role did race play in this election, this past election?
Not as much as we thought it would. I remember covering the election, and no matter how well Barack Obama seemed to be doing after a certain point, people kept saying, but just wait till Election Day. There's going to be a lot of people who won't tell the truth to pollsters who are going to come out and vote against him because he was black. Or they said, look how the polls misread things in New Hampshire. We thought he was going to win according to the polls, and he lost on Election Day to Hillary Clinton. What does that tell us? Well, what it told us in the case of New Hampshire, we now know, is that things changed at the end. There were technicalities which were wrong. They stopped taking polls before the last weekend of the campaign, and that's when the shift happened among New Hampshire voters. A lot of things were happening under the surface which pollsters didn't pick up, including Hillary Clinton's very clever appeal to women voters, and not just the welling up, getting teary-eyed in the diner, but also making a direct mail appeal that a lot of people didn't notice under the radar to women on abortion rights. So there was that, which proved not to be a rat race. And then in the end, when we saw the final numbers, we saw that Barack Obama did better among white voters than John Kerry did 4 years before. So this whole idea that people are sitting around voting against their own self-interests because of race, it didn't hold water this year. It may have held water with other elections in past years, but I would argue that the Bradley effect, as they call it, because it started in California years ago in a gubernatorial race there, the idea that people at the end would vote against their self-interest because of race, that went away. It's gone away over a period of time with several different candidates over the years. But it doesn't mean that there wasn't a hard nut of people who looked at him and said, he's a black man, I won't vote for him. It just means that in the end, people had a lot of other reasons. They are more sophisticated than we give them credit for, and that race would not be the determining reason in the end. They might vote against him because they didn't think he would fix the economy. They might vote against him because they didn't think he had enough experience. These were perfectly reasonable arguments to make, but it wasn't automatically tied to race.
Well, and I don't know how much we really know about what was in the minds of voters, that is, non-black voters, white voters, Hispanics, Asian Americans, everybody other than black voters. You know, I don't really know if we know what was in their minds. But particularly for white Americans, I wonder if you have a sense of how many people perhaps voted for Mr. Obama. They voted for him because they thought he'd be a good president, but how race figured in and whether there were some people who might actually have his being black was important to them, and how many people would say something and maybe could say it honestly, like, well, that really didn't enter into things. I didn't really even think about that much.
I hear a lot of people say that. I don't know how many people mean that. I want to raise a shocking possibility, which is that people, black and white, voted with race in mind, but considered it a positive instead of a negative, a reason to vote for someone instead of a reason to vote against someone. The biggest turnaround came among white voters because black voters and other voters of color have always crossed racial lines to cast votes. It's never been something which stopped them. It's only white voters who would hesitate. So if you just look at white voters and you say that they, I don't know that there's been any exhaustive, accurate, surveys done that can say what was really on the minds of white voters, but I do think that's the question you have to ask. And once again, I think in the end, what Barack Obama did in his campaign, and which what all these breakthrough candidates, it was interesting to just stumble across the things they had in common. What they all did was they said, you know what? Yeah, sure, I'm black. You can look at me and see that. But that's not what this is about. But this is about the things we have in common. So even Jesse Jackson in 1988, when I covered his campaign, spent a lot of time telling audiences, we care about the same things. We care about our economic future. We care about our health care. We care about our parents' retirement and our own retirement. Let's focus on the things we have in common. And once you realize that you're making your judgment, your voter's judgment, based on the things that you want a leader to do for you, you are more likely to put race aside. It doesn't mean that it won't factor into your thinking. It doesn't mean that you're not going to look at it and say, this is a positive, this is a negative, or I'd like to make history. That would be a great thing. But for instance, if you look at how black voters voted in the beginning for early primaries, they were not on board in the early polling with Barack Obama. There was no knee-jerk automatic race pride because a black guy was running for president. They, too, did not know who he was. They were very familiar with Hillary Clinton and the Clintons. And it took Barack Obama winning in Iowa and proving that he could change minds among white voters before black voters started coming to his side. So there's a lot of practicality in how people cast their votes, which puts race as a factor, but not a determining factor, as much as it has been in the past.
All right, let's talk with caller. We have one person here ready to go, here in Champaign County, where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I would like to, I'm sure you'll get back to the election cycle and the implications, but I would like to ask you about the book's thesis itself, I don't know if it's sort of a passing of the torch kind of idea, but perhaps a compare and contrast would be interesting. I interacted with Juan Williams with his book Enough on this airwaves, and I find him absolutely infuriating. It seems to me that it's a Washington consensus kind of blame the victim only, same kind of victimology language that you get from a Rush Limbaugh on occasion. So I'm getting a little lost on it, but I'd like for you to tell how you contrast your point of view with that kind of very just sort of, I think, simple-minded just approach to the legacy of civil rights. I mean, he's done a lot of other work,
I'm happy to talk to you about that. I mean,
please.
I think the biggest contrast between the thesis I make in my book and what Juan was making in his book is I think Juan's is a little dated. I think there is an old, thoroughly chewed over notion that the Jesse Jacksons and the Al Sharptons are to blame for some sort of paucity of black leadership in America. What I try to do is dig a little bit under the surface without dismissing the role that Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and other leaders of their generation have brought. Look at this other generation, which is happening under the surface. The idea that black people, unique among all races, need to be led somewhere by a single leader is gone. The idea, however, that there is a generation of folks who came of age at a time when race was a factor in their lives and not the factor, and who did not need to march and protest in order to gain acceptance to, you know, elite schools and other kinds of advantageous places. The fact that those people are still turning to public service and still are interested in serving the people who they represent, including the very poorest of the poor in the Black Belt of Alabama and the poorest of the poor in the inner city of Newark, many of whom are disproportionately African American, means that we have a different kind of leader, which is playing out in all kinds of levels. And I'm talking about in mayors, city halls, and I'm talking about in state legislatures, like in California, where the Speaker of the House is an African American woman. Or the Speaker Pro Tem in Louisiana is African-American women. These are people who are using public service as a way to speak to some of the same ills and concerns identified by the first wave and some of the people that Juan dismisses. They're just using it a different way. They're taking use of the laws which are now handed to them and trying to use it to their advantage. So what you will have is a new generation breakthrough black leader who will say, rather than I'm going to demonstrate on the mall in favor of jobs for black people or health care for black people, this same breakthrough leader will say, I'm going to see if I can do what I can to get health care for everyone, with the understanding that the people who will benefit disproportionately will be people from my community. That's just not the only people I'm speaking for and to. So I think I'm going a little deeper, I hope, and trying to dig a little bit more into who are the people who have reaped the fruits of the labors of the other generation, the older generation of civil rights leaders, and using it differently. It's a different kind of civil rights.
Well, if you look at the indicators for the African-American community, I mean, a Poor People's March would be in order. I mean, the statistics are awful, and healthcare.
What would a Poor People's March accomplish, though?
Well, I think to actually change things, masses in the streets are important. I wanted to also include class in this too, and you have a little bit, because the idea that solving all poor people's problems would help African Americans. But I'm still struck by the. I guess I am going back to the election, and it's you said that you felt it's inappropriate to say that there's anything post-racial about American society, but how much do you think way that Obama ran his campaign and sort of implicit in what you said as a strategy of not focusing on, how much of that allowed people to vote who do harbor this idea that, you know, there's some kind of color blindness going on?
I'm sure a lot of people who voted for him do believe that, and that's, if you're a politician, all you want is the vote. Why they secretly vote for you is really beside the point. The point is to get them to vote for you. So that's where the politician's responsibility ends. I don't happen to think that colorblindness exists, because my basic tenet is, I don't understand why you would not want to see my color. If it's part of who I am, it's not all of who I am, but it is certainly a defining characteristic. It's like having someone snatch your purse and they run away and the policeman says, describe him, and you say, well, he's tall and he's got brown hair and he's wearing a green jacket, but you don't describe his race. So the policeman goes out and covers it and looks for everybody wearing a green jacket instead of saying, well, it turns out, he was Korean, that which might have been an identifying characteristic. Why wouldn't you want to mention it? The point being that it's not that you don't mention race or that you don't notice race. It's just that you try to not always use it as a negative, as a point of conflict, as something in which we're finger-pointing in guilt. Because as long as someone feels guilty, they're not likely to do anything for or with you. And that's the new conversation which I think a lot of Black elected officials are having.
I'm going to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. We're already at our midpoint. I want to introduce again our guest and invite some other folks into the conversation. We're talking this morning with Gwen Ifill. She's moderator, managing editor of Washington Week, the PBS program. She's also a senior correspondent of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Before coming to PBS, she was chief congressional and political correspondent for NBC News. She's also been a reporter for The New York Times, Washington Post, Baltimore Sun, and the Boston Herald-American. She's the author of a recent book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. It's published by Doubleday. It's in the bookstores now, has been out for a while. And if you'd like to read the book, you can look for it. And here on the program, questions are welcome too, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. We've talked a little bit about political strategy and the kind of strategy that the candidates like those, including Mr. Obama, but not limited to Mr. Obama, have used. Something else I think it's interesting that you talk about that has always been the common advice to candidates that you secure your base first, and then you go out and see who else you can get. These candidates, they went the other way around.
They did. It's kind of a outside in rather than a trickle down version of politics, which is if you assume. It requires a certain amount of arrogance on your part about your base. You have to assume your base is going to come home to you. Not without some cultivation, because Barack Obama and others, they spend a lot of time on Black radio and doing other things to speak to Black audiences, but in a way that does not alienate the larger audience, the larger voting bloc they're searching for, the people who really need to be convinced for the first time to vote outside of their comfort level. Because African Americans have a much greater history of voting outside their comfort level, because those are many often the only choices they had, it was kind of a different challenge. If you want to be elected from a district that is majority Black or that has been gerrymandered in such a way to benefit an African-American candidate, you don't need to reach outside your base. But if you're running statewide or you're running nationwide or you're running in some sort of in a multi-ethnic district, it is incumbent upon a good politician to figure a way to speak to as many voters as possible and not to alienate them. So that's the challenge. It's really quite a tightrope. And most of the breakthrough candidates who I profile all had to figure a way to master it at some point or another. And when they didn't master it, they ran in elections and lost. And when they did, including Barack Obama, including Arthur Davis and Cory Booker, when they did master it, they won.
We have some other callers. We have two here in line, and we'll go next to someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello, Ms. Ifill. I'm proud of you and what you're doing, especially on the Lehrer Report.
Thank you.
I do, however, I'm an African-American man who grew up in Arkansas when it was Jim Crow. And when my father and grandfather had to pay a poll tax, among other things, to vote, and they did, notwithstanding the risk to themselves and their jobs. And I'm very, very excited about President Barack Obama reaching what I consider the highest level an African-American could reach in this country. And believe me, I never thought it would happen during my lifetime. Given that, however, especially coming from an impoverished region of the country, even though I've been in the Midwest for several years, even though when I go to Chicago, I understand how impoverished it is. And even when I go to North Champaign and North Urbana, I understand how impoverished African Americans live. My asked question to you is how can, and I think the Urban League's recent report from Mauriel, and I can't remember his first name now.
Mark Mauriel.
Mark Mauriel, a very distinguished gentleman, Urban League, and the A for Enforce Empowerment Economically of African Americans, reflecting the tremendous dichotomies between how prosperous the white community is as opposed to how non-prosperous the black community is. And I think even Mark Muriel on one of the talk shows sort of issued a challenge to President Obama. And I was conflicted by that because I didn't know whether President Obama, who is arguably a colorblind president, and I'm putting that in quotes, would react when a black group as powerful as Urban League sort of says, what are you going to do for black folk who are still suffering so much? My question to you, and it also goes to Booker and the mayor of Washington and all of these black leaders, that if even if you get elected to positions we had no reason to imagine a few years ago that you would, how can you reach down as a part of the talented 10th that Dr. Du Bois talked about and lift up the 9/10 of African-Americans still suffering from the pathologies of racism and bigotry in this country?
Well, I think any of these candidates I talk to understand there's a special responsibility that they carry. The question is, do they carry a greater responsibility than, say, any white president would have? I think Mark Morial, anything he has had to say to this president is something he would have said to any president. It's a responsibility of any president to do it. Now, the question becomes, what is the answer? Does the president who is African-American have a special responsibility? I remember Deval Patrick telling me he always felt the sense that in Massachusetts that African-Americans, of which they're only 7% of the population, but that they looked at him and thought he had a special responsibility, and it was one he felt he had as well. The question is, how do you carry out that responsibility? Do you run the risk of being seen as the president for Black America instead of all America? Or do you find a way to make your larger goals disproportionately benefit African Americans or people, let's take race out of it, just poor people in general? You know, there are more white poor people than black poor people, just the numbers. So the question is, how do you speak to all of the disadvantaged, and do you speak to them? Do you do it in a subtle fashion? For instance, there's a lot of subtlety on view at the White House these days. If you go in the Oval Office, what used to be the place where there used to be a bust of Winston Churchill when George W. Bush was president has now been replaced by a bust of Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. When Michelle Obama has school children to the White House, she explains to them that the building was built by slaves. When they had their first honoree, their first black tie dinner, and their first in performance at the White House, the entertainment was, you know, Stevie Wonder and Earth, Wind, and Fire. I mean, how much do you, just by your actions, and those last two are just examples, but how much do you, just by your actions, demonstrate your concern and your follow-through for the community? How much of that does it matter that you have this intact whole African-American family in the White House? And what does that speak? How does that speak to families in impoverished situations? A lot of that counts for a lot. Now, does that mean that the president should stand on the mall and lead a march? Even Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, who were anti-abortion, never personally would show up at the anti-abortion marches on the mall. They would send a message and not personally show up, which made their base unhappy, but that's the way they dealt with it. So if there's a big march on the mall and Barack Obama doesn't show up, does that become somehow a greater loss on his part? It's a good question. I think we're going to have to watch that unfold. He's getting a pass for now because there are such incredible things on his plate. It is such a complicated and difficult situation digging out of the economic hole that we're in that I don't think anyone's going to beat up on him about social issues until, you know, because we'll all sink unless they can figure a way to rescue the more immediate problems, which speak to everyone.
Thank you, ma'am.
No, thank you. Just very quickly, and no question about it, the election of Barack Obama was an historic event. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, though, that many people, among the questions they ask is, what for other African-Americans running for office, what is the significance of his victory?
Well, in reporting this book, I was reporting it about the same time as the campaign was going along. And many of the African-American elected officials I talked to were all very enthused about Barack Obama, but they did not believe for a moment that his election was going to guarantee their success. It does open people's minds to the possibility of leadership, just like having a woman Secretary of State when Madeleine Albright was picked seemed unusual, but now we've had two others, and it no longer seems unusual to have a woman in that job. In fact, it seems unusual to have a white male in that job. Just having someone in this position can change the way the world is viewed and can certainly change opportunities for the next wave of African-American officials.
Just one of the people that you write about in the book, Archer Davis, he's a congressman from Alabama. He apparently would like to run for governor. Is that on?
I call that the audacity of hope. But he has actually announced he is running. His campaign is going, and he is running for governor in 2010. And in order to do that, it's a steep way to go, because Barack Obama, in the end, did not do all that well among white voters in Alabama. I believe he got 20% of the white vote. And Archer Davis was looking at that and saying, well, maybe if he gets 40% of the white vote, I'm in a good position. So he's trying to find a way to close all those gaps as well. That's going to be an interesting case in point to follow.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Gwen Ifill. She's the moderator of the PBS program Washington Week, senior correspondent of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Her recent book is The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Next caller here in line is on line number two, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a different sort of question for you, Ms. Ifill. A few weeks ago, there was heated conversation between the White House and the Republican Party addressing who was actually in charge of the Republican Party, whether it was the elected chairman or Rush Limbaugh. And my question is, do you think it serves the White House well to get involved in these kinds of issues, as opposed to sticking to the main themes of the president's agenda?
Well, I think these kinds of issues are awfully inside for most Americans. People who are worrying about whether their mortgage is going to get paid are don't really care whether Rush Limbaugh or Michael Steele are running the party. That's a side issue. What the White House, I think, was trying to do was be mischievous in getting involved in that, because their polling shows that among a larger percentage of Americans, Rush Limbaugh may not be as popular as he is among core Republicans. And most of these people don't know who Michael Steele is at all. That little squabble is very internal, very inside politics, and has incredibly little to do with anybody else's life.
So it was just a stone in the water that disappeared very quickly.
Well, I think that's why I say they were just being mischievous. They like to stir the pot, but they knew that there wasn't much they could lose, because that's not what people are focused on.
Oh, thank you.
All right, thank you. And what do you make of the fact that here after this election, with the election of the first African-American president, that suddenly the Republican Party chooses as its head a man who is African-American?
Yeah, I'm not really very cynical about that. I think that, especially since it took many different ballots for Michael Steele to win that election to be party chair, so he was not the automatic choice. This one wasn't like someone looked down and said, oh, they've got a black president, let's find our black guy. He ran hard and maneuvered and played the inside politics game to get that post. Now, once he got that post, all of a sudden everyone started noticing that he was African-American and wondering if that was a good or a bad thing. By comparison, the Republican Party is going through precisely what every losing party does after you've lost, like, the House, the Senate, and the White House, which is a reexamination of how you survive. The Democrats did this when it lost control, and it's never pretty. And so they're trying to sort their way out who is speaking for the majority, who is speaking for the base, and are these two things the same?
All right. Next is a community of Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning, all. Mr. Obama, if things go right for President Obama, he could easily be nominated for being put up on Mount Rushmore. But what he's done just very recently makes me wonder just exactly what's going on, and that is he's gone along with this bailout of the financial magnates that get their big bucks in the end, but here he's forcing the auto union members to take a lot of changes in their contracts. Obviously, there's a lot more African Americans in the unions than there are on Wall Street magnates, so it makes me wonder what's going on here.
Well, first of all, the Mount Rushmore thing, I think, is a long ways off. I think that he has so many difficult mountains to climb before he gets to Mount Rushmore that the chances of him failing, frankly, are much greater than success, at least on every single one of the things on his plate. But I think you have to step back and look at what he is doing in all of these areas and assess them separately. At least that's what they appear to be doing. In assessing the auto companies, I guess I can only tell you that the White House view on this is that it wasn't like they woke up yesterday and said, I think I'll punish the union members. They gave GM, this is their third opportunity to come forward with a rescue plan. And they came up with a rescue plan that according to all the economists on the president's auto task force, is way too optimistic. Everything has to go right in order for the plan that GM put forward to work. And that still was going to involve job loss. That still was going to involve shuttered plants. So they say it's not going to work. And so the GM has either got to figure a way to shed a lot of jobs, shed a lot of its nameplate, shed a lot of the business plan that it's operated on for these last 30 years, and find a way to reorganize itself, which is what they're calling structured bankruptcy, or it will just go out of business when a whole lot more jobs will be lost. Same thing with Chrysler. Chrysler, they said, is not a viable standalone company anymore. And so in order for it to succeed, it has to have a partner. That's the tough. They call it tough love, but it's just tough to a lot of folks who are hearing bad news. When you have to deal with any kind of rescue plan, any kind of digging out of a hole, a whole lot of people are going to suffer. Now, it's a perfectly fair question to ask, why is it that the bankers seem to be reaping more than the auto companies? But I think it's a little apples and oranges as well, because there are different sets of, even among the auto companies, there are different sets of the demands, different needs, different stresses, and when the government had to deal with it differently. But one thing that's in common is the government is playing an unprecedented role in the private sector in order to stop the entire economy, in its view, from just sliding off the side of the earth.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. Our lines are full, and we're getting short on time, so I'd like to go and give another a chance. We'll go next to Oakland, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I got the impression during this last election, to overstate it a bit, but that our country is sort of undergoing a seismic shift, and the old guard is changing over to a new guard, and the old guard's not real happy about losing their position and their status and control, and yet also that our country hasn't quite settled on what our new vision is going to be. And you see it with the economic problems that we're facing. You see it in the social issues we're facing. And I was just wondering how much of this change is more about a sort of an attitudinal change than it is about just the black-white issue.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. You have completely, I believe, summed up the whole thesis of my book. And I think that one of the things we in America get caught up in race, we can't help ourselves, is what we do. But I also think that at the root of it, this is a much more substantial generational change than it was a racial shift. It was significant, it was important, and it's something that we can't underestimate.
Mm. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. Let's go next to Monticello, line 1. Hello. Is your caller there? Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
It's a little bit like some of the other questions, and it relates, some issues about inclusion and exclusion from the political process. And I guess my question is that I became very enthusiastic about, now President Obama, because of the fact that he brought people into the process that hadn't been at the table before and really didn't have a chance to be at the table. And so I guess my question is, how does he now, in the position where he's the ultimate insider, kind of negotiate, permitting people who didn't have voices to be part of the process that really affects their lives in the most basic ways, but also have to deal with the fact that he's now the insider and, has to work within that process?
It's a great question, and I don't think we know the answer to it yet. There is no question that when you're running for the big, big job as the outsider, in the end, you still have to deal with the job, what's on your plate, what's on your table, and he has to be the insider. And I think there are a lot of expectations out there that he was going to come in and somehow shake everything up. But you can't shake everything up when it's pretty much shook when you get there. So there are a whole lot of things he has to establish first. But I do think he's going to have to figure a way, and I don't think anybody knows what that is yet, to keep the enthusiasm and the kind of the change mandate that so many people who were drawn to his campaign wanted to see, and not lose that enthusiasm, because that's what in the end is going to save him in tough spots when he's losing all kinds of other people who maybe weren't as enthusiastic but voted for him grudgingly or will be the first ones off the reservation. I don't know that he's figured out how to do that yet, I have to say.
But you don't think he's forgotten that those who haven't had voices deserve to have voice?
I can't tell you what he's forgotten and what he knows, quite honestly.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right, thank you. Line number two next, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah. Is there any chance that in the revision of our economy that the legal and political leaders and recipients of whatever it is that we allow them to use will accept the idea that they should have the same kind of economic prerogative that people at Conway Trucking, Caterpillar, and American Car and Wheel, where their pay is reduced by half, their benefits are reduced by half or more, and their cost of living goes up by, say, 300 to 500% a year?
Mm. I guess the question is whether the people who are at the top of the scale should be losing as much as people at the bottom of the scale?
It sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think if there were some way to apply just one ruler and have everybody take the same hit, that would be very satisfying to a lot of people. But I don't know how you impose that in a democracy.
Hmm. We're at the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I want to thank the caller. In fact, I want to thank all the callers. One issue I want to have you talk at least a little bit about here is gender. And I'm sure that there were a lot of Democrats who, when we were at the point that on the Democratic side this came down to a two-person race, were almost pained by the choice that they had to make, because I'm sure that there were a lot of people, women particularly, who really were very excited about the idea of a woman running for president and being elected. And maybe a lot of those people would also be very excited about the idea of a person of color running and being elected. How in all this, you know, we've talked a lot about race and what it meant in this election. Can you say something about gender and what it meant?
There was quite a lot of a clash, you remember, during the Hillary Clinton Barack Obama primary process, and a lot. I remember one woman saying to me, an older woman who had, you know, worked for women's rights her whole career, saying to me, "But I'm so sad about." This is when Barack Obama was winning. I'm so sad that I may not ever be able to dance at the inauguration of a female president. I mean, there was a lot of real sorrow involved in this. There was also a lot of bitterness among some women who felt that Barack Obama was simply cutting in line when it was a woman's turn. Obama was completely aware of that and the dangers of that, which is why much of his general election was spent trying to heal those wounds. And much of his early presidency has also been spent trying to heal those wounds, if you pay attention to a lot of the appointments he's made who have come from the Hillary land, as we used to call it, and a lot of the support that he has now gotten back behind him from people who supported her. In fact, I've talked to, you know, Barack Obama supporters who have been unhappy that it was easier to get a job in the administration if you worked for Hillary Clinton than if you worked for him, because they were so busy trying to mend those wounds. So, yeah, there were a lot of bad feelings. Some people ask me constantly whether I think the next breakthrough at the presidential level will be a woman after having gotten so close to those 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling that Hillary Clinton talked about. There's no reason why not. Certainly we didn't know, you know, 8 years ago that Barack Obama existed, let alone that he would be president in 2009. So, in fact, in 2004 was the first time most people had ever heard his name when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention. There's no reason to believe there's not a woman out there poised for that same kind of breakthrough.
Yeah. Oh, back at the beginning, I said I wanted to at least have you talk a little bit about the controversy in advance of the vice presidential candidates debate and what a lot of conservative pundits and bloggers, they said, and this was in advance of the book actually having been published, so nobody had actually seen it. They said, oh, here we go. Gwen Ifill, she's written this pro-Obama book, we'll put that in quotes, and so how could she possibly be a fair and impartial moderator at the debate? And there was a lot of, and I looked back at some of it, and I thought a lot of it was pretty ugly, the stuff that was said about you.
I didn't see most of it until after it was over because I just decided not to read most of it. I was surprised how much ink people wasted on this.
Well, and I also wondered if you were at all surprised about just how nasty and personal it was.
You know, I have to say, I think that a lot of people are nasty and personal who don't know you and aren't very informed. So now that the book is out, people can read the book and decide for themselves whether I wrote a pro-Obama book. I think that a lot of those critics have since been silenced, because if they actually read the book, which most of them don't really want to spend the time to do, they would discover that what they said was uninformed and incorrect. I knew at the time that I was not writing a pro-Obama book. I knew that I was writing something which was a far more kind of thoughtful than most people wanted it to be. And it was an easy attack to make that a black reporter was not capable of being anything else but pro-Obama. But it was not true. I knew it wasn't true. And I could have spent a lot of energy having my feelings hurt by strangers attacking me. Instead, I decided to attach value to people who read the book, knew what I was writing about, and knew my work, and had followed my work 30 years in journalism, and knew whether I was capable of this. People who had actually noticed that I had moderated a debate 4 years before and managed to do it fairly without criticism. So I spent a lot of I'm fairly self-confident enough about my abilities that I knew, and I'm also aware enough of how politics works to know that a lot of this was just people stirring up dust. I also was aware that even at its nastiest, it wasn't as nasty as some of the things people said to my father when he tried to gain access to public accommodations growing up, you know, in this country. I just know that this is just chatter, and chatter doesn't cut very deep. And so I took it in stride. I don't know where I got that. Maybe I got that from my parents, but people calling names didn't really bother me, because I could just say, well, here's the book. And if you really want to have a discussion about what I was actually doing, what I was actually saying, and what I was actually capable of, then let's talk about it. I mean, the same people who spend all their day blogging and writing criticisms of me on the left accused me of being best friends with Condoleezza Rice when she was Secretary of State, and now the people on the right say I'm in bed with Barack Obama. So I kind of take it all with the same sense of whatever, because if it's not true, I really have other things I could be doing and spending my time on.
Yeah. You can see our guest, Gwen Ifill, on public television. She's the moderator and managing editor of the program Washington Week, also senior correspondent of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And also she's the author of the book The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Came out was it in the fall that it actually...
It came out in January.
It came out in January. Okay, right at the beginning of the year. So it's still fresh, and it's out in the bookstores if you want to read it, published by Doubleday. Ms. Ifill, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, thank you so much for having me.